Welcome to episode 21 of Old Stories, New Information. I'm your host, Brent Colley. And on today's episode, I'm joined by Elizabeth Boyce, who writes articles for the Easton Courier and is the keeper of things, or curator, at the Easton Historical Society. So welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi, Brent. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Your recent article in the Easton Courier, like Hidden in Plain Sight, it just fascinated me. And in episode 18, we interviewed Sharon Cohen, and I know that she spoke at the Society on the topic of Connecticut companies that helped the war effort in World War II. But she missed what you found in Easton, and your first sentence was the perfect hook. It says, imagine an FBI agent dispatched from Washington, D.C., headed north on a reconnaissance mission, ending up right here in Easton, Connecticut. So how did you come up with this topic?
It's pretty unbelievable, right?
Yeah.
Well, during the COVID shutdown, just like with Sharon, I started to look closely at our archives, and I found within the scrapbooks in our collection mention of a factory here in Easton during World War II. And that's really interesting because at that time, and you know Easton, it's mostly farmland, reservoir and water company land. And I discovered Mirko Pagnieco and his engineering factory that was over here on Wilson Road.
And that's like in the middle of nowhere, really. I mean, I grew up in Reading, Easton, and Reading, you know, Shara High School. So I know the area, and it's pretty fascinating. So what is his background? So how did he end up producing this audio equipment?
So Mirko actually was born in the Ukraine in 1908, and he escaped that war-torn area in 1919. He was educated in Europe. His father, he was a diplomat, and so he attended some of the very best schools at the time there. He was a trained classical pianist, and he was a polyglot. I mean, he was fluent in five languages. But the thing that really stands out from his early years is that he was this tinkerer. He was creating crystal radios very early on in his life, and amplifiers and phonographs. So when he was invited to come and study here at MIT to study engineering in 1926, he continued that hobby. And he sort of turned his studio apartment, which apparently was above a Chinese laundry shop, he turned it into a production workshop where he built phonographs and he sold them. They became widely regarded for their sound quality.
So that's like from there, did he build the business off of that?
He did, yeah. He acknowledged very early on that he didn't create anything new with his product, but he achieved his success by putting these components together in a very efficient manner. He used the best materials that he could afford, and the sound quality served as his best advertisement because he hosted these parties at his apartment and cultivated a sort of salon where the hoi polloi of Boston came and gathered. He had musicians, conductors, celebrities, politicians even, coming to listen to music in his little studio apartment. And that way he built his client base and built up advertising by word of mouth.
So what kind of systems is he like making for these clients? And like, so give me a little bit more about the clients themselves and like what kind of things they were buying from him.
It's pretty amazing because he ended up selling audio equipment to millionaires who paid top dollar for these systems. One famous installation was for Curtis Bock. He had a beautiful installation done. It cost about $12,000 at the time. Just to give you an idea of what that is today, that was about $270,000 today. And wow. That was basically for a phonograph, remote control, and speaker systems.
Wow. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So then, I mean, where's he living in this moment in time?
So he starts off in Boston.
Then where do you go from there?
From there, he ends up in New York City. He was living with his wife, who, by the way, was, she was a graduate of Smith College, Lenore Lane, from a very wealthy family in New Hampshire. She was very savvy, and she actually took care of his bookkeeping and, was responsible for, I think, a lot of his networking and his connections. They turned their apartment in New York City into a very similar kind of salon where, people came to listen to the music, and that cultivated the clients.
Wow, that's pretty smart.
Yes, from there, the Easton connection came about. He had a friend from time when he worked at Sikorsky, William J. Pollitt, and they started producing phonographs and audio equipment in Pollitt's house in Bridgeport. I guess at some point he was working in Bridgeport, and Pollitt's father was an engineer for the Bridgeport Hydraulic Company. And somehow through that connection, William and Mirko moved their workshop to an abandoned farmhouse and barn on Water Company property on Wilson Road. That was down in 1936.
Wow. So that's a neat connection. That makes a lot of sense. And then so what happens when he gets to Easton? How does he, obviously he makes a factory, but how did that all come into play?
Well, you know, by the time they established their factory and workshop there, the war broke out. So in 1939, Pollitt leaves to serve in the armed forces, and Mirko stayed on in Easton. He built a workshop on the first floor, and he, you know, as the war progressed and he had gotten war contracts, he expanded the structure. It was really, you know, we were fortunate to actually visit the site, so we could see all the different wings that he attached. And he was very careful as, you know, to keep the exterior appearance as a barn to disguise what was being done on the inside because it was very sensitive equipment. And, you know, he had probably an increase from 20 employees from before the war to over 100. And so even though it was, you know, out of the way, and very few people knew about it, it was quite a war industry there.
Yeah, that's big. I'd imagine he's drawn a lot from either Bridgeport or Fairfield or, you know, those areas.
He did, yeah. Most of his employees were from Bridgeport and the Fairfield area, but many were from right here in Easton. He also hired lots of skilled immigrants from Hungary, Poland, and Italy, and he was known to have created a really warm, welcoming family environment.
Now, what about so the FBI tie-in? So obviously he's producing products for the war, and what was the big concern of the FBI? Why would they come?
So any company during that time period that was producing sensitive equipment had to have armed guards. But Mirko basically said that that was not necessary. He thought it would attract undue attention. So the FBI decided to investigate, and they sent an agent from Washington, D.C. up to Bridgeport. From Bridgeport, he couldn't figure out where, you know, this factory was. He ended up going to Fairfield. From Fairfield, he ended up wandering around Easton's roads for hours. By the end of the day, he finally ended up on Wilson Road and, you know, needless to say, concluded armed guards weren't necessary.
Yes, we did it driving in cars as high schoolers, but I can only imagine if you're doing it on foot, it's even tougher.
Yeah.
So in terms of the war and the contracts, he was also doing other things, like with universities, you said, and art centers?
Yeah, outside of the contracts for the government, his business really was for art centers, for symphony halls. The universities were commissioning lots of equipment from him, audio players, radio phonographs. I don't know if you remember this, but do you remember the listening tables? I remember when I was in college, we would have our language labs at these huge oak listening tables where you'd sort of plug your headphones in.
I was
working off of an MP table because most of the universities in the Northeast had them.
And it's interesting about his impact in terms of not only sound but also recording. You mentioned that he was able to record a lot of musicians in that time frame.
He did. Orchestras would seek him out for his equipment and also to consult with him, and he expanded his business to include different company divisions. So MP Productions was a division that was making movie reels for the government and also promotional pieces. You can actually pull up today a piece on Tanglewood, and that's an MP production.
Wow. So did his business change quite a bit after the war, or did he kind of stay within that as we head into the 50s and 60s?
As he head into the 50s, he did try to expand. He had a sort of failed stint with TV production. A lot of his clients wanted to have TV units from him. He wasn't a big fan of television. He thought it was a fad. And as far as I could tell from my research, I think he was the only manufacturer of TVs in Connecticut, at least that I know of. But he economically, he really couldn't make that work. And he realized also that, you know, he had been the music person for millionaires, but he needed to create more affordable product lines to stay in business. So you do see at this time MP advertisements in newspapers, and it didn't really seem to help much. He was a small business.
What about his life in Easton? So did he have any impact on the town outside of the role as an employer, or did he do other things?
Huge impact. I mean, both he and his wife were very active in town, and you go through the scrapbooks, you see that Lenore was in the Women's League of Voters. She was in the PTA. He also was in the Exchange Club. He was donating audio equipment to the libraries, the churches, to the schools. This was really high-end audio equipment, and Easton Public Schools had it. So
oh, wow.
I think that's pretty interesting. I keep hoping that we'll find it, but I think it's long gone.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, you know, what if we were able to find and you know what it sounded like? That's the true mystery there.
It would be amazing.
Yeah. But,
you know, he also volunteered in the schools. He was teaching electricity and did the elementary school and the middle school kids. So he took a great care in his community. And I think for him, you know, when you listen to some of his interviews, you realize that he really thought that Easton was the epitome of the American dream, and he was so incredibly happy here.
So what happens to him? What happens to him? What happens to his company as we move forward?
Well, you know, by the 60s, going back a little bit, I think one of the biggest flaws in his character was that he really loved living large, and he definitely was overspending. Once he obtained that property, it was actually given to him for about a dollar by the Bridgeport Hydraulic Company after the war was over. And with that ownership, he really invested in it. He built this incredible barn loft where he helped, you know, he did lots of entertaining and showcased his equipment. He had walls with fountains installed around his property. He had the first Hartree tennis court installed in a private residence in the United States, was here in Easton on his property. Really extensive, expensive installations there. He also entertained, so much so that, I mean, from interviews he said, Zsa Zsa Gabor would be there, you know, lots
wow.
of celebrities. He had a private chef. He had a private tennis coach living with he and his family. All of these expenses and a sort of downturn in his business really meant financial ruin. So by the mid-50s, early 60s, his company was in trouble. And by the 60s, Lenore had left him. That was a really big part of his business there. So he didn't. So the company ends up turning more as a repair shop in the 1970s, going into the 1980s, and he passes away in 1986.
Well, you got to visit that, and that must have been, like, fantastic.
Right, yes. So the property was bought by a local farmer in 1989, and he kept all of Mirko's stuff just the way it had been. Honestly, when you entered the factory barn, it was as though he just left for lunch.
Wow, that's neat.
It was a little eerie as well, but it was wonderful because the new owners who bought the property during COVID reached out to the Historical Society, and it's absolutely wonderful when new residents see something that might have historical importance, and they reach out to us to document it. It's such an important thing to do. So So we photographed
the space. No, I totally agree. It's a really neat story. Like I said, I was fascinated by the article because it's just in a location that you wouldn't think that it would be. And then to learn about his life and his skills, you know, that was something that really stood out. I mean, he obviously knew more than, you know, others in that industry. And I think, like, one of the things that I like to crawl back to is figuring out, like, where did he get his parts? How did he get his parts? And things of that nature. But that's just what historians do. So what do you hope, you know, now that you've kind of, you know, pulled back some layers, what do you want to achieve as you head forward on this subject?
Well, I really hope that this helps place Panieko in the context of our town's history, because he did create a very interesting community space. That barn space is actually, you know, give you some perspective on that. When we entered it, we realized it is larger than our current Easton community room at the Easton Library. So this large space was used by local groups to have guest speakers, local writers, artists. They all came there for different events. Stuart Chase from Reading was invited by the League of Women Voters. They held their meetings there. So his barn was not just a showroom. It was also a community space where high schoolers had dances, college reps came to talk to local young people about, you know, their future studies and careers. I'm hoping that in the future more research is going to show more correspondences between the people of Easton and Mirko.
Yeah, no, it's one of these things that, you know, we all enjoy is, you know, once you start looking into a topic, so much more comes to the forefront. So that's why I thought it'd be important to have you on today so that more people outside of our small little world of Reading and Easton would know more about this individual and his products and his role. And so I hopefully from here forward we succeed in that.
I hope so, too. Yeah, it's a really great story.
I mean, we have so many great topics. I mean, Easton and Reading have so much more than really people know. I mean, Helen Keller, is, you know, how she got there. You know, that's a topic that, you know, we continue to tell kids about. I was just down in Reading yesterday. You know, we're helping kids from third grade up learn about the history of their town because many of the kids, you know, didn't grow up there. They moved there from other locations. So, you know, these little things, these little important topics, you know, maybe initially it seems small, but they really grow into something much larger, and it's a really important part of local history. So I appreciate you being here today.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
And it's been fun. That's what I strive for. It's always got to be fun. So for the listeners, as we noted in all episodes, there's an email account you can write to, stories@robinhoodradio.com. Tell us what you want to know more about, and we'll circle back. So until next time, be well and always do right. This will gratify some people and astonish the rest. Enjoy your week.
Old Stories, New Information with Brent Colley is produced at the studios of WHDD 91.9 FM, robinhoodradio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.